The opinions expressed on this program are solely those of its hosts, guests, or callers, and do not necessarily represent the opinions of WTBR-FM, its management, other producers, or sponsors.
Welcome to Beyond, an hour-long program of science fiction and fantasy. I am your host, Beverly Prentice. I hope you enjoy the program. If so, please drop a line to beyond3x5 at gmail.com. The Circular Valley by Paul Bowles. The abandoned monastery stood on a slight eminence of land in the middle of a vast clearing. On all sides, the ground sloped gently downward toward the tangled, hairy jungle that filled the circular valley, ringed about by sheer black cliffs. There were a few trees in some of the courtyards, and the birds used them as meeting places when they flew out of the rooms and corridors where they had their nests. Long ago, bandits had taken whatever was removable out of the building. Soldiers had once used it as headquarters. Like the bandits had built fires in the great windy rooms so that afterward they looked like ancient kitchens. And now that everything was gone from within, it seemed that never again would anyone come near the monastery. The vegetation had shown up a protecting wall. The first story was soon quite hidden from view by small trees which dripped vines to lasso the cornices of the windows. The meadows round about grew dank and lush. There was no path through them. At the higher end of the circular valley, a river fell off the cliffs into a great cauldron of vapor and thunder below. After this, it slid along the base of the cliffs until it found a gap at the other end of the valley, where it hurried discreetly through, with no rapids, no cascades. A great thick black rope of water moving swiftly downhill between the polished flanks of the canyon. Beyond the gap, the land opened out and became smiling. A village nestled on the side hill just outside. In the days of the monastery, it was there that the friars had got their provisions, since the Indians would not enter the circular valley. Centuries ago, when the building had been constructed, the church had imported the workmen from another part of the country. They were traditional enemies of the tribes thereabouts and had another language. There was no danger that the inhabitants would communicate with them as they worked at setting up the mighty walls. Indeed, the construction had taken so long that before the east wing was completed, the workmen had all died, one by one. Thus it was the friars themselves who had closed off the end of the wing with blank walls, leaving it that way, unfinished and blind-looking, facing the black cliffs. Generation after generation, the friars came, fresh-cheeked boys who grew thin and gray and finally died, to be buried in the garden beyond the courtyard with the fountain. One day not long ago, they had all left the monastery. No one knew where they had gone. No one thought to ask. It was shortly after this that the bandits and then the soldiers had come. And now, since the Indians do not change, still no one from the village went up through the gap to visit the monastery. Atajala lived there. The friars had not been able to kill it, had given up at last and gone away. No one was surprised, but the Atajala gained in prestige by their departure. During the centuries, the friars had been there in the monastery. The Indians had wondered why it allowed them to stay. Now, at last, it had driven them out. It always had lived there, they said, and would go on living there, because the valley was its home, and it could never leave. In the early morning, the restless Atajala would move through the halls of the monastery. The dark rooms spread past, one after the other. In a small patio where eager young trees had pushed up the paving stones to reach the sun, it paused. The air was full of small sounds, the movements of butterflies, the falling to the ground of bits of leaves and flowers. The air following its myriad courses around the edges of things, the ants pursuing their endless labors in the hot dust. In the sun it waited, conscious of each gradation, in sound, in light, and smell, living in the awareness of the slow, constant disintegration that attacked the morning and transformed it into afternoon. When evening came, it often slipped above the monastery roof and surveyed the darkening sky. The waterfall would roar distantly. Night after night, along the procession of years, it had hovered there above the valley, darting down to become a bat, a leopard, a moth for a few minutes or hours, returning to rest immobile in the center of the space enclosed by the cliffs. When the monastery had been built, it had taken to frequenting the rooms, where it had observed for the first time the meaningless gestures of human life. And then one evening, it had aimlessly become one of the young friars. This was a new sensation, strangely rich and complex, and at the same time, unbearably stifling, as though every other possibility, besides that of being enclosed in a tiny, isolated world of cause and effect, had been removed forever. As the friar, it had gone and stood in the window, looking out at the sky, seeing for the first time, not the stars, but the space between and beyond them. Even at that moment, it had felt the urge to leave, to step outside the little shell of anguish where it lodged for the moment, but a faint curiosity had impelled it to remain a little longer and partake a little further of the unaccustomed sensation. It held on. The friar raised his arms to the sky in an imploring gesture. For the first time, the Atala Jala sensed opposition, the thrill of a struggle. It was delicious to feel the young man striving to free himself of its presence, and it was immeasurably sweet to remain there. Then, with a cry, the friar had rushed to the other side of the room and seized a heavy leather whip hanging on the wall. Tearing off his clothing, he had begun to carry out a ferocious self-beating. At the first blow of the lash, the Atala Jala had been on the point of letting go. But then it realized that the immediacy of that intriguing inner pain was only made more manifest by the impact of the blows from without. And so it stayed and felt the young man grow weak under his own lashing. When he had finished and said a prayer, he crawled to his pallet and fell asleep weeping, while the Atala Jala slipped out obliquely and entered into a bird, which passed the night sitting in a great tree on the edge of the jungle, listening intently to the night sounds and uttering a scream from time to time. Thereafter, the Atajala found it impossible to resist sliding inside the bodies of the friars. It visited one after the other, finding an astonishing variety of sensation in the process. Each was a separate world, a separate experience, because each had different reactions when he became conscious of the other being within him. One would sit and read or pray. One would go for a long, troubled walk in the meadows, around and around the building. One would find a comrade and engage in an absurd but bitter quarrel. A few wept. Some flagellated themselves or sought a friend to wield the lash for them. Always there was a rich profusion of perceptions for the Atala Jalala to enjoy, so that it no longer occurred to it to frequent the bodies of insects, birds, and furred animals, nor even to leave the monastery and move in the air above. Once it almost got into difficulties when an old friar it was occupying suddenly fell back dead. That was a hazard it ran in the frequency of men. They seemed not to know when they were doomed or if they did know, they pretended with such strength not to know that it amounted to the same thing. The other beings knew beforehand, save when it was a question of being seized unawares and devoured, and that the Atijala was also able to prevent. A bird in which it was staying was always avoided by the hawks and eagles. When the friars left the monastery and, following the government's orders, doffed their robes, dispersed, and became workmen, the Atijala was at a loss to know how to pass his days and nights. Now everything was as it had been before their arrival. There was no one but the creatures that always had lived in the circular valley. It tried a giant serpent, a deer, a bee. Nothing had the savor it had grown to love. Everything was the same as before, but not for the Atijala. It had known the existence of man, and now there were no men in the valley, only the abandoned building with its empty rooms to make man's absence more poignant. Then one year bandits came, several hundred of them in one stormy afternoon. In delight, it tried many of them as they sprawled about, cleaning their guns and cursing, and it discovered still other facets of sensation. The hatred they felt for the world, the fear they had of the soldiers who were pursuing them, the strange gusts of desire that swept through them as they sprawled together drunk by the fire that smoldered in the center of the floor, and the insufferable pain of jealousy which the nightly orgies seemed to awaken in some of them. But the bandits did not stay long. When they had left, the soldiers came in their wake. It felt very much the same way to be a soldier as to be a bandit. Missing were the strong fear and the hatred, but the rest was almost identical. Neither the bandits nor the soldiers appeared to be at all conscious of its presence in them. It could slip from one man to another without causing any change in their behavior. This surprised it, since its effect on the friars had been so definite, and it felt a certain disappointment at the impossibility of making its existence known to them. Nevertheless, the Atijala enjoyed both bandits and soldiers immensely, and was even more desolate when it was left alone once again. It would become one of the swallows that made their nest in the rocks beside the top of the waterfall. In the burning sunlight, it would plunge again and again into the current of mist that rose from far below, sometimes uttering exultant cries. It would spend a day as a plant louse, crawling slowly along the underside of the leaves, living quietly in the huge green world down there, which is forever hidden from the sky. Or at night, in the velvet body of a panther, it would know the pleasure of the kill. Once, for a year, it lived in an eel at the bottom of the pool below the waterfall, feeling the mud give slowly before it as it pushed ahead with its flat nose. That was a restful period. But afterward, the desire to know again the mysterious life of man had returned, an obsession of which it was useless to try to rid itself. And now it moved restlessly through the ruined rooms, a mute presence, alone, and thirsting to be incarnate once again, but in man's flesh only. And with the building of highways through the county, it was inevitable that people should come once again to the circular valley. A man and a woman drove their automobile as far as a village down in the lower valley. Hearing about the ruined monastery and the waterfall that dropped over the cliffs into the great amphitheater, they determined to see such things. They came on burros as far as the village outside the gap, but there the Indians they had hired to accompany them refused to go any farther, and so they continued alone upward through the canyon and into the precinct of the Atijala. It was noon when they rode into the valley. The black ribs of the cliffs glistened like glass in the sun's blistering downward rays. They stopped the burros by a cluster of boulders at the edge of sloping meadows. The man got down first and reached up to help the woman off. She leaned forward, putting her hands on his face, and for a long moment they kissed. Then he lifted her to the ground, and they climbed hand in hand up over the rocks. The Atajala hovered near them, watching the woman closely. She was the first ever to have come into the valley. The two sat beneath a small tree on the grass, looking at one another, smiling. Out of habit, the Atajala entered into the man. Immediately, instead of existing in the midst of the sunlit air, the bird calls and the plant odors, it was conscious only of the woman's beauty and her terrible imminence. The waterfall, the earth, and the sky itself receded, rushed into nothingness, and there was only the woman's smile and her arms and her odor. It was a world more suffocating and painful than the Atajala had thought possible. Still, while the man spoke and the woman answered, it remained within. "Leave him. He doesn't love you. He would kill me. But I love you. I need you with me. I can't. I'm afraid of him." The man reached out to pull her to him. She drew back slightly, but her eyes grew large. "We have today," she murmured, turning her face toward the yellow walls of the monastery. The man embraced her fiercely, crushing her against him as though the act would save his life. "No, no, no, it can't go on like this," he said. "No." The pain of his suffering was too intense. Gently, the Atajala left the man and slipped into the woman. And now it would have believed itself to be housed in nothing, to be in its own spaceless self. So completely was it aware of the wandering wind, the small flutterings of the leaves, and the bright air that surrounded it. Yet there was a difference. Each element was magnified in intensity. The whole sphere of being was immense, limitless. Now it understood what the man sought in the woman, and it knew that he suffered because he could never attain that sense of completion he sought. But the Atajala, being one with the woman, had attained it, and being aware of possessing it, trembled with delight. The woman shuddered as her lips met those of the man. There, on the grass in the shade of their tree, their joy reached new heights. The Atajala, knowing them both, formed a single channel between the secret springs of their desires. Throughout, it remained within the woman and began vaguely to devise ways of keeping her, if not inside the valley, at least nearby, so that she might return. In the afternoon, with dreamlike motions, they walked to the burros and mounted them, driving them through the deep meadow grass to the monastery. Inside the great courtyard, they halted, looking hesitantly at the ancient arches in the sunlight and at the darkness inside the doorways. "Shall we go in?" said the woman. "We must get back." "I want to go in," she said. The Atajala exulted. A thin gray snake slid around the ground into the bushes. They did not see it. The man looked at her perplexedly. "It's late," he said. But she jumped down from her burrow by herself and walked beneath the arches into the long corridor within. Never had the rooms seemed so real as now when the Atajala was seeing them through her eyes. They explored all the rooms. Then the woman wanted to climb up into the tower, but the man took a determined stand. "We must go back now," he said firmly, putting his hand on her shoulder. "This is our only day together, and you think of nothing but getting back. But the time, there is a moon. We won't lose the way." He would not change his mind. "No." "As you like," she said. "I'm going up. You can go back alone if you like." The man laughed uneasily. "You're mad." He tried to kiss her. She turned away and did not answer for a moment. Then she said, "You want me to leave my husband for you. You ask everything from me. But what do you do for me in return? You refuse even to climb up into a little tower with me to see the view. Go back alone. Go. She sobbed and rushed toward the dark stairwell. Calling after her, he followed but stumbled somewhere behind her. She was as sure of foot as if she had climbed the many stone steps 1,000 times before, hurrying up through the darkness, around and around. In the end, she came out at the top and peered through the small apertures in the cracking walls. The beams which had supported the bell had rotted and fallen. The heavy bell lay on its side in the rubble like a dead animal. The waterfall's sound was louder up here. The valley was nearly full of shadow. Below, the man called her name repeatedly. She did not answer. As she stood watching the shadow of the cliffs slowly overtake the farthest recesses of the valley and begin to climb the naked rocks to the east, an idea formed in her mind. It was not the kind of idea which she would have expected of herself, but it was there, growing and inescapable. When she felt it complete there inside her, she turned and went lightly back down. The man was sitting in the dark near the bottom of the stairs, groaning a little. "What is it?" she said. "I hurt my leg. Now are you ready to go or not?" "Yes," she said simply. "I'm sorry you fell." Without saying anything, he rose and limped after her out into the courtyard where the burrows stood. The cold mountain air was beginning to flow down from the tops of the cliffs. As they rode through the meadow, she began to think of how she would broach the subject to him. "It must be done before they reach the gap," the Atul Jala trembled. "Do you forgive me?" she asked him. "Of course," he laughed. "Do you love me more than anything in the world? Is that true?" He glanced at her in the failing light, sitting erect on the jogging animal. "You know it is," he said softly. She hesitated. "There is only one way, then," she said finally.
"But what?"
"I'm afraid of him. I won't go back to him. You go back. I'll stay in the village here."
Being that near, she would come each day to the monastery.
"When it is done, you will come and get me. Then we can go somewhere else. No one will find us." The man's voice sounded strange.
"I don't understand."
"You do understand, and that is the only way. Do it or not, as you like, it is the only way." They trotted along for a while in silence. The canyon loomed ahead, black against the evening sky. Then the man said very clearly, "Never." A moment later, the trail led out into an open space high above the swift water below. The hollow sound of the river reached them faintly. The light in the sky was almost gone. In the dusk, the landscape had taken on false contours. Everything was gray. The rocks, the bushes, the trail, and nothing had distance or scale. They slowed their pace. His words still echoed in her ears.
"I won't go back to him," she cried with sudden vehemence. "You can go back and play cards with him as usual. Be his good friend the same as always. I won't go. I can't go on with both of you in the town." The plan was not working. The Atul Jala saw it had lost her, yet it still could help her. "You're very tired," he said softly. He was right. Almost as he said the words, that unaccustomed exhilaration and lightness she had felt ever since noon seemed to leave her. She hung her head wearily and said, "Yes, I am." At the same moment, the man uttered a sharp, terrible cry. She looked up in time to see his burrow plunge from the edge of the trail into the grayness below. There was a silence, and then the faraway sound of many stones sliding downward. She could not move or stop the burrow. She sat dumbly, letting it carry her along, an inert weight on its back. For one final instant, as she reached the pass, which was the edge of its realm, the Atul Jala alighted tremulously within her. She raised her head, and a tiny, exultant shiver passed through her. Then she let it fall forward once again. Hanging in the dim air above the trail, The Atalajala watched her indistinct figure grow invisible in the gathering night. If it had not been able to hold her here, still it had been able to help her. A moment later, it was in the tower, listening to the spiders mend their webs that she had damaged. It would be a long, long time before it would bestir itself to enter into another being's awareness. A long, long time. Perhaps forever. Lane the Wayfarer by Jack Vance. Through the dim forest came Lane the Wayfarer, passing along the shattered glades with a prancing light-footed gait. He whistled, he caroled, he was plainly in high spirits. Around his finger he twirled a bit of wrought bronze, a circlet graved with angular crabbed characters, now stained black. By excellent chance he had found it, banded around the root of an ancient yew. Hacking it free, he had seen the characters on the inner surface, rude, forceful symbols, doubtless the cast of a powerful antique rune. Best take it to a magician and have it tested for sorcery. Lane made a wry mouth. There were objections to the course. Sometimes it seemed as if all living creatures conspired to exasperate him. Only this morning, the spice merchant. What atonement he had made dying. How carelessly he had spewed blood on Lane's coxcomb sandals. Still, thought Lane, every unpleasantness carried with it compensation. While digging the grave, he had found the bronze ring. And Lane's spirit soared. He laughed in pure joy. He bounded. He leapt. His green cape flapped behind him. The red feather in his cap winked and blinked. But still, Lane slowed his step. He was no whit closer to the mystery of the magic, if magic the ring possessed. Experiment. That was the word. He stopped where the ruby sunlight slanted down without hindrance from the high foliage, examined the ring, traced the glyphs with his fingernail. He peered through. A faint film. A flicker? He held it at arm's length. It was clearly a coronet. He whipped off his cap, set the band on his brow, rolled his great golden eyes, preened himself. Odd. It slipped down on his ears. It tipped across his eyes. Darkness. Frantically, Lane clawed it off. A bronze ring? A hand's breadth in diameter? Queer. He tried again. It slipped down over his head, his shoulders. His head was in the darkness of a strange, separate space. Looking down, he saw the level of the outside light dropping as he dropped the ring, slowly down. Now it was around his ankles. And in sudden panic, Lane snatched the ring up over his body, emerged blinding and blinking into the maroon light of the forest. He saw a blue-white, green-white flicker against the foliage. It was a Twickman, mounted on a dragonfly, and light glinted from the dragonfly's wings. Lane called sharply, "Here, sir! Here, sir!" The Twickman perched his mount on a twig. "Well, Lane, what do you wish? Watch now and remember what you see." Lane pulled the ring over his head, dropped it to his feet, lifted it back. He looked up to the Twickman, who was chewing a leaf. "And what did you see?" "I saw Lane vanish from mortal sight, except for the red curled toes of his sandals. All else was as air." "Ha!" cried Lane. "Think of it! Have you ever seen the like?" The Twickman asked carelessly, "Do you have salt? I would have salt." Lane cut his exultation short, eyed the Twickman closely. "What news do you bring me?" "Three herbs killed Florigen, the dream builder, and burst all of his bubbles. The air above the manse was colored for many minutes with the flitting fragments." A gram. Lord Candive the Golden has built a barge of carven mowood 10 lengths high, and it floats on the river Sacrum for the regatta, full of treasure. 2 grams. A golden witch named Lith has come to live on Thamber Meadow. She is quiet and very beautiful. 3 grams. Enough, said the Twick Man, and leaned forward to watch while Lane weighed out the salt in a tiny balance. He packed it in small panniers hanging on each side of the rib thorax, then twitched the insect into the air and flicked off through the forest vaults. Once more, Lane tried his bronze ring, and this time brought it entirely past his feet, stepped out of it, and brought up the ring into the darkness beside him. What a wonderful sanctuary! A hole whose opening could be hidden inside the hole itself. Down with the ring to his feet, stepped through, holding it up his slender frame and over his shoulders, out into the forest with a small bronze ring in his hand. Ho, and off to Thamber Meadow to see the beautiful golden witch. Her hut was a simple affair of roving weeds. A low dome with 2 round windows and a low door. He saw Lith at the pond, bare-legged among the water shoots, catching frogs for her supper. A white kirtle was gathered up tight around her thighs. Stock still she stood, and the dark water rippled rings away from her slender knees. She was more beautiful than Lane could have imagined. As if one of Florigen's wasted bubbles had burst here on the water. Her skin was pale, cream-stirred gold, her hair a denser, wetter gold. Her eyes were like Lane's own, great golden orbs, and hers were wide apart, tilted slightly. Lane strode forward and planted himself on the bank. She looked up, startled, her ripe mouth half open. "Behold, Golden Witch, here is Lane. He has come to welcome you to Thamber, and he offers you his friendship, his love." Lith bent, scooped a handful of slime from the bank and flung it into his face. Shouting the most violent curses, Lane whipped his eyes free, but the door to the hut had slammed shut. Lane strode to the door and pounded it with his fist. "Open! And show your witch's face, or I burn the hut." The door opened, and the girl looked forth, smiling. "What now?" Lane entered the hut and lunged for the girl, but 20 thin shafts darted out, 20 points pricking his chest. He halted, eyebrows raised, mouth twitching. "Down, steel," said Lith. The blade snapped from view. "So easily could I seek your vitality," said Lith, "had I willed." Lane frowned and rubbed his chin as if pondering. "You understand," he said earnestly, "what a witless thing you do. Lane is feared by those who fear fear, loved by those who love love, and you." His eyes swam the golden glory of her body. "You are ripe as a sweet fruit. You are eager. You glisten and tremble with love. You please Lane, and he will spend much warmness on you." "No, no," said Lith with a slow smile. "You are too hasty." Lane looked at her in surprise. "Indeed, I am Lith," said she. "I am what you say I am. I ferment, I burn, I seethe. Yet I may have no lover but him who has served me. He must be brave, swift, cunning." "I am he," said Lane. He chewed at his lip. "It is not usually thus. I detest this indecision." He took a step forward. "Come, let us..." She backed away. "No, no. You forget. How have you served me? How have you gained the right to my love?" "Absurdity," stormed Lane. "Look at me. Note my perfect grace, the beauty of my form and feature. My great eyes as golden as your own, my manifest will and power. It is you who should serve me. That is how I will have it." he sank upon a low divan. Woman, give me wine. She shook her head. In my small domed hut, I cannot be forced. Perhaps outside on Thamber Meadow, but in here, among my blue and red tassels, with 20 blades of steel at my call, you must obey me. So choose, either arise and go, never to return, or else agree to serve me on one small mission, and then have me all and all my ardor. Lane sat straight and stiff, an odd creature, the Golden Witch. But, indeed, she was worth some exertion, and he would make her pay for her impudence. Very well, then, he said blandly. I will serve you. What do you wish, jewels? I can suffocate you in pearls, blind you with diamonds. I have 2 emeralds the size of your fist, and they are green oceans where the gaze is trapped and wanders forever among vertical green prisms. No, no jewels. An enemy, perhaps? Ah, so simple. Lane will kill you 10 men. 2 steps forward, thrust, thus, he lunged, and souls go thrilling up like bubbles in a beaker of mead. No, I want no killing. He sat back, frowning. What then? She stepped to the back of the room and pulled at a drape. It swung aside, displaying a golden tapestry. The scene was a valley bounded by 2 steep mountains, a broad valley where a placid river ran, past a quiet village, and so into a grove of trees. Golden was the river, golden the mountains, golden the trees, gold so various, so rich, so subtle, that the effect was like a many-colored landscape. But the tapestry had been crudely hacked in half. Lane was entranced. Exquisite! Exquisite! Lith said, it is the magic valley of Arriventa, so depicted. The other half has been stolen from me, and its recovery is the service I wish of you. Where is the other half? Demanded Lane. Who is the dastard? Now she watched him closely. Have you ever heard of Chun? Chun the Unavoidable? Lane considered. No. He stole the half to my tapestry and hung it in a marble hall, and this hall is in the ruins to the north of Caen. Ha! Muttered Lane. The hall is by the Palace of Whispers, and is marked by a leaning column with a black medallion of a phoenix and a 2-headed lizard. I go, said Lane. He rose. One day to Caen, one day to steal, one day to return, 3 days. Lith followed him to the door. Beware of Chun the Unavoidable, she whispered, and Lane strode away whistling, the red feather bobbing in his green cap. Lith watched him, then turned and slowly approached the golden tapestry. Golden Arriventa, she whispered, my heart cries and hurts with longing for you. The Derna is a swifter, thinner river than the Sycam, its bosomy sister to the south, and where the Sycam swallows through a broad dale, purple with horse blossom, pocked white and gray with crumbling castles. The Derna has a sheared, steep canyon, overhung by forested bluffs. An ancient flint road long ago followed the course of the Derna, but now the exaggeration of the meandering has cut into the pavement, so that Lane, treading the road to Caen, was occasionally forced to leave the road and make a detour through banks of thorn and tube grass which whistled in the breeze. The red sun drifting across the universe like an old man creeping to his deathbed hung low to the horizon when Lane breasted Porphyron's scar, looked across white-walled Caen and the blue bay of San Real beyond. Directly below was the marketplace, a medley of stalls selling fruit, slabs of pale meat, mollusks from the slime banks, dull flagons of wine, and the quiet people of Cayenne moved among the stalls, buying their sustenance, carrying it loosely to their stone chambers. Beyond the marketplace rose a bank of ruined columns, like broken teeth, legs to the arena built 200 feet from the ground by Mad King Shin. Beyond, in a grove of bay trees, the glassy dome of the palace was visible, where Candive the Golden ruled Cayenne, and as much of Aeschylus as one could see from a vantage on Porphyrin's Scar. The Derna, no longer a flow of clear water, poured through a network of dank canals and subterranean tubes, and finally seeped past rotting wharves into the bay of San Real. A bed for the night, thought Lane, then to his business in the morning. He leapt down the zigzag steps, back, forth, and came out into the marketplace. And now he put on a grave demeanor. Lane the Wherefarer was not unknown in Cayenne, and many were ill-minded enough to work him harm. He moved sedately in the shade of the Panum wall, turned through a narrow cobbled street, bordered by old wooden houses, glowing the rich brown of old stump water in the rays of the setting sun, and so came to a small square and the high stone face of the Magician's Inn. The host, a small fat man, sad of eye, with a small fat nose, the identical shape of his body, was scraping ashes from the hearth. He straightened his back and hurried behind the counter of his little alcove. Lane said, "A chamber, well aired, and a supper of mushrooms, wine, and oysters." The innkeeper bowed humbly. "Indeed, sir, and how will you pay?" Lane flung down a leather sack, taken this very morning. The innkeeper raised his eyebrows in pleasure at the fragrance. The ground buds of the spare space bush, brought from a far land, said Lane. "Excellent, excellent. Your chamber, sir, and your supper at once." As Lane ate, several other guests of the house appeared and sat before the fire with wine, and the talk grew large and dwelt on wizards of the past and the great days of magic. "Great Fandal knew a lore now forgot," said one old man with hair dyed orange. "He tied white and black strips to the legs of sparrows and sent them veering to his direction. And where they wove their magic woof, great trees appeared, laden with flowers, fruits, nuts, or bulbs of rare liquors. It is said that thus he wove great De Forest on the shores of Sandra Water." "Ha," said a dour man in a garment of dark blue, brown, and black. "This I can do." He brought forth a bit of string, flicked it, whirled it, spoke a quiet word, and the vitality of the pattern fused the string into a tongue of red and yellow fire, which danced, curled, darted back and forth across the table till the dour man killed it with a gesture. "And this I can do," said a hooded figure in a black cape sprinkled with silver circles. He brought forth a small tray, laid it on the table, and sprinkled therein a pinch of ashes from the hearth. He brought forth a whistle and blew a clear tone, and up from the tray came glittering motes, flashing the prismatic colors, red, blue, green, yellow. They floated up a foot and burst into coruscations of brilliant colors, each a beautiful star-shaped pattern, and each burst sounded a tiny repetition of the original tone, the clearest, purest sound in the world. The motes became fewer, the magician blew a different tone, and again the motes floated up to burst in glorious ornamental spangles. Another time, another swarm of notes. At last the magician replaced his whistle, wiped off the tray, tucked it inside his cloak, and lapsed back into silence. Now the other wizards surged forward, and soon the air above the table swarmed with visions quivered with spells. One showed the group 9 new colors of ineffable charm and radiance. Another caused a mouth to form on the landlord's forehead and revile the crowd, much to the landlord's discomfiture, since it was his own voice. Another displayed a green glass bottle from which the face of a demon peered and grimaced. Another, a hall of pure crystal, which rolled back and forth to the command of the sorcerer who owned it, and who claimed it to be an earring of the fabled master, Sankofarin. Lane had attentively watched all, crowing in delight at the bottled imp, and trying to cozen the obedient crystal from its owner, without success. And Lane became pettish, complaining that the world was full of rock-hearted men. But the sorcerer with the crystal earring remained indifferent, and even when Lane spread out 12 packets of rare spice, he refused to part with his toy. Lane pleaded, "I wish only to please the witch Lith." "Please her with the spice, then," Lane said ingenuously. "Indeed, she has but one wish, a bit of tapestry which I must steal from Chun the Unavoidable." And he looked from face to suddenly silent face. "What causes such immediate sobriety? Ho, landlord, more wine!" The sorcerer with the earring said, "If the floor swam ankle deep with wine, the rich red wine of Tranquillin, the leaden paint of that name, would still stride the air." "Ha!" laughed Lane. "Let only a taste of that wine pass your lips, and the fumes would erase all memories." "See his eyes," came a whisper, "great and golden." "And quick to see," spoke Lane. "And these legs, quick to run, fleet as starlight on the waves, and this arm, quick to stab with steel, and my magic, which will set me a refuge that is out of all cognizance." He gulped wine from a healer. "Now behold, this is magic from antique days." He set the bronze band over his head, stepped through, brought it up inside the darkness. When he deemed that sufficient time had elapsed, he stepped through once more. The fire glowed. The landlord stood in his alcove. Lane's wine was at hand, but of the assembled magicians, there was no trace. Lane looked about in puzzlement. "And where are my wizardly friends?" The landlord turned his head. "They took to their chambers. The name you spoke waited on their souls." And Lane drank his wine in frowning silence. Next morning he left the inn and picked a roundabout way to the old town, a gray wilderness of tumbled pillars, weathered blocks of sandstone, slumped pediments with crumbled inscriptions, flagged terraces overgrown with rusty moss. Lizards, snakes, insects crawled the ruins. No other life did he see. Threading a way through the rubble, he almost stumbled on a corpse, the body of a youth, one who stared at the sky with empty eye sockets. Lane felt a presence. He leapt back, rapier half-bared. A stooped old man stood watching him. He spoke in a feeble, quavering voice. "And what will you have in the old town?" Lane replaced his rapier. "I seek the place of whispers. Perhaps you will direct me." The old man made a croaking sound at the back of his throat. "Another? Another? When will it cease?" He motioned to the corpse. "This one came yesterday seeking the place of whispers. He would steal from Chun the Unavoidable. See him now." He turned away. "Come with me." He disappeared over a tumble of rock. Lane followed. The old man stood by another corpse, with eye sockets bereft and bloody. "This one came 4 days ago, and he met Chun the Unavoidable. And over there behind the arch is another still, a great warrior in cloisonné armor. And there, he pointed and there, like crushed flies. He turned his watery blue gaze back to Lane. Return, young man, return, lest your body lie here in its green cloak to rot on the flagstones. Lane drew his rapier and flourished it. I am Lane the Wayfarer. Let them who offend me have fear. And where is the place of whispers? If you must know, said the old man, it is beyond that broken obelisk. But you go to your peril. I am Lane the Wayfarer. Peril goes with me. The old man stood like a piece of weathered statuary as Lane strode off. And Lane asked himself, suppose this old man were an agent of Chun, and at this minute were on his way to warn him. Best to take all precautions. He leapt up on a high entablature and ran crouching back to where he had left the ancient. Here he came, muttering to himself, leaning on his staff. Lane dropped a block of granite as large as his head. A thud, a croak, a gasp, and Lane went on his way. He strode past the broken obelisk into a wide court, the place of whispers. Directly opposite was a long, wide hall, marked by a leaning column with a big black medallion, the sign of a phoenix and a two-headed lizard. Lane merged himself with the shadow of a wall and stood watching like a wolf, alert for any flicker of motion. All was quiet. The sunlight invested the ruins with dreary splendor. To all sides, as far as the eye could reach, was broken stone, a wasteland leached by a thousand rains. Until now the sense of man had departed, and the stone was one with the natural earth. The sun moved across the dark blue sky. Lane presently stole from his vantage point and circled the hall. No sight nor sign did he see. He approached the building from the rear and pressed his ear to the stone. It was dead, without vibration. Around the side, watching up, down to all sides, a breach in the wall, Lane peered inside. At the back hung half a golden tapestry. Otherwise, the hall was empty. Lane looked up, down, this side, that. There was nothing in sight. He continued around the hall. He came to another broken place. He looked within. To the rear hung the golden tapestry. Nothing else. To right or left, no sight or sound. Lane continued to the front of the hall and sought into the caves, dead as dust. He had a clear view of the room, bare, barren, escape for the bit of golden tapestry. Lane entered, striding with long, soft steps. He halted in the middle of the floor. Light came to him from all sides, except the rear wall. There were a dozen openings from which to flee, and no sound except the dull thudding of his heart. He took two steps forward. The tapestry was almost at his fingertips. He stepped forward and swiftly jerked the tapestry down from the wall. And behind was Chun the Unavoidable. Lane screamed. He turned on paralyzed legs, and they were leaden, the legs in a dream which refused to run. Chun dropped out of the wall and advanced. Over his shiny black back, he wore a robe of eyeballs threaded on silk. Lane was running fleetly now. He sprang, he soared. The tips of his toes scarcely touched the ground. Out the hall, across the square, into the wildness of the broken statues and fallen columns. And behind came Chun, running like a dog. Lane sped across the crest of a wall and sprang a great gap to a shattered fountain. Behind came Chun. Lane darted up a narrow alley, climbed over a pile of refuse, over a roof, down into a court. Behind came Chun. Lane sped down a wide avenue lined with a few stunted old cypress trees, and he heard Chun close at his heels. He turned into an archway, pulled his bronze ring over his head down to his feet. He stepped through. brought the ring up inside the darkness. Sanctuary. He was alone in a dark magic space, vanished from earthly gaze and knowledge. Brooding silence, dead space. He felt a stir behind him, a breath of air. At his elbow, a voice said, "I am Chun, the unavoidable." Lith sat on her couch near the candles, weaving a cap from frog skins. The door to her hut was barred. The windows shuttered. Outside, Thamber Meadow dwelled in darkness. A scrape at her door, a creak as the lock was tested. Lith became rigid and stared at the door. A voice said, "Tonight, O Lith, tonight it is two long bright threads for you, two because the eyes were so great, so large, so golden." Lith sat quiet. She waited an hour, then creeping to the door, she listened. The sense of presence was absent. A frog croaked nearby. She eased the door ajar, found the threads and closed the door. She ran to her golden tapestry and fitted the threads into the raveled warp. And she stared at the golden valley, sick with longing for Araventa, and tears blurred out the peaceful river, the quiet golden forest. The cloth slowly grows wider. One day it will be done, and I will come home.